KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Parts of the country are seeing the highest number of tuberculosis cases in decades. Federal health officials say this year's flu season is the worst in 15 years, and they're watching the spread of bird flu and its potential threat to humans. These looming dangers come at a time when Native health officials are reeling for mixed messages from the federal government, headed by a health secretary who has worked to discredit the effectiveness of vaccines. We'll hear from people keeping watch on these developments right after the news.
National Native News, I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A Lake Superior tribe in Wisconsin says a Canadian energy firm's plans to reroute an oil and gas pipeline will violate its water quality standards under the Clean Water Act. Danielle Kading has more.
Energy firm Enbridge wants to reroute Line 5 after the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa sued the company in 2019 to shut down and remove the pipeline from its lands. Line 5 carries up to 23 million gallons of oil and natural gas liquids daily from Superior to Sarnia, Ontario. Federal regulators signed off on the tribe's water quality standards in 2009. Bad River Tribal Chair Robert Blanchard says the reroute would harm the tribe's resources.
Because there's many more streams and tributaries and everything that runs towards Bad River, into Bad River, out into Lake Superior.
Earth Justice attorney Stephanie Sosi represents the tribe. She says it's possible blasting bedrock to install the pipe could unearth elements that could become hazardous when exposed.
The blasting materials themselves could be hazardous and introduce hazardous components to the water.
She says those may include PFAS, mercury, or other chemicals. An Enbridge spokesperson says the company is confident the project will not significantly impact water quality or exceed the tribe's standards. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
U.S. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski has introduced a bill that would officially designate North America's highest mountain as Denali, its Koyukon Athabascan name. The legislation would require that any reference in U.S. laws, maps, or other records refer to the mountain as Denali. This comes after President Trump's executive order to change the name back to Mount McKinley. Murkowski spoke about the mountain on the Senate floor last week, saying for Alaskans, it will always be Denali. She says her action follows the Alaska State Legislature, which recently moved a resolution urging the administration and the U.S. Board on Geographic Names to maintain the name. And as KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, the fight to preserve the name is an old battle.
If she were alive today, Pauline Carla would probably sing her Denali song to protest President Trump's executive order. Carla was in her late 90s when she performed her Denali song at a Dinakanaga Elders and Youth Conference. She had greeted President Obama with that same song when he visited Alaska in 2015, the summer his administration changed the name back from McKinley to Denali.
What I'm saying here is, say Denali, say Denali.
When it was named back to the original name of Denali, it just felt so good, and it was healing.
Angela Gonzalez remembers when Pauline sang that song for Obama. In her Athabascan Woman blog, she wrote about it and the joy she felt over the return of the ancient name.
Just the feeling of a great land and untold stories from our ancestors.
Angela's maiden name is Yatlin, which means runner, and refers to her family's long history of trading goods.
We definitely traveled a long ways.
Where the mountain was part of a long network of trails that went all the way from Siberia to California. And Denali, which means tall one in her Koyukon Athabascan language, was an important landmark. Angela says no matter what the president does, Denali will always be Denali. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at aarp.org.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
When you file online for your PFD, every Alaskan can support great causes like National Native News. Just select KNBA-FM Kawanak Broadcast Corporation. With your support, you can help us make a difference in our community.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Thanks to vigorous public health efforts, the United States has one of the lowest tuberculosis infection rates in the world. That's why recent surges of the disease in Kansas and North Carolina have public health officials concerned. The flu, which is always a risk, is flooding doctors' offices more than usual, and health officials say the threat of bird flu for humans is relatively low, but infections continue for chickens and other livestock. These health threats are surfacing against a backdrop of uncertainties about Indian Health Service funding, a lapse in public health information from the CDC, and a new U.S. health secretary who has openly spoken against vaccines. Today we'll speak with medical experts and others about current public health threats and how events might play out under the new presidential administration. We also want to hear from you. Please share comments and questions by calling 1-800-996-2848. You can also comment on our website or our social media pages. Let's meet today's guests. Dean Seneca joins us from New York. He is the CEO and founder of Seneca Scientific Solutions. He is Seneca. Dean, it's always good to have you on the show. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Joining us from Denver, Colorado is Dr. Robert Belknap. He is the executive director of the Public Health Institute at Denver Health. Dr. Belknap, it's great to have you back as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Shonda Hessen joins us from Anchorage, Alaska, where she is a nurse consultant for the state of Alaska's Section of Epidemiology. She is also the lead nurse consultant for the Alaska Department of Health's tuberculosis team. Good morning, Shonda, and welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for inviting me.
It's a pleasure to have you along with our other guests. And Dr. Belknap, I want to begin with you. We're seeing these rising cases with the seasonal flu, tuberculosis, and also bird flu. How concerned should we be right now? And are any of these illnesses out of the ordinary?
Well, I won't say they're out of the ordinary when it comes to influenza. This is the time of year where we see that and other respiratory viruses circulating. This is a year that's worse than other recent years, and in some areas seemingly the worst we've seen in maybe 15 years in terms of influenza. Tuberculosis, a little different. It's, as you mentioned at the beginning, we've had lower rates in the U.S. for a while, but globally tuberculosis has been a constant problem really for centuries and has remained a problem that doesn't get talked about often. And so we are seeing some increases, and that's been true post-pandemic across the country in cases of tuberculosis. And then the bird flu remains a low risk to public health, but an area of concern and one that we're monitoring closely.
Let's talk more about tuberculosis. How does it spread, and what are reasons that it might hit one area harder than another?
Yeah, so tuberculosis it spreads through the air. So you have to be around someone who is sick with tuberculosis, usually for an extended period of time. So it's typically many hours. And so the people who are at highest risk are people often who live with someone who has gotten sick from tuberculosis. If you breathe it into your lungs, it gets into the body. Most of the time, people won't get sick from it right away and may never get sick from it. We have the ability to trap the TB bacteria inside of us. What we don't do very well is get rid of it. And so a person can have the TB infection for years or even decades. And then later in life, maybe because of other illnesses, if someone develops diabetes or develops a condition that lowers their immune system, the tuberculosis can wake up and can make them sick. Sometimes that happens for unknown reasons. So people without other conditions, the tuberculosis wakes up and it begins to cause symptoms and cause disease in them. In cases where if that happens and there's transmission in an area, we can see other people getting sick from tuberculosis. It's very different than the viruses that we're used to hearing about, the influenza, COVID-19, where typically if you're exposed and infected, you're much more likely to get sick within mm-hmm. days to a week or so. With tuberculosis, you may not get sick for a long period of time. That can be to our advantage and is one of the reasons that we have been able to reduce tuberculosis in the U.S. is by identifying people who have been exposed and testing them and finding out if they've been infected. We can treat someone who's been infected with tuberculosis and prevent them from getting sick later in life.
And in the event someone does get sick with tuberculosis, doctor, what are the symptoms?
Yeah, the usual symptoms are gradual in nature. It's typically a cough that's persisting and worsening over many weeks. That cough is generally productive, so bringing up phlegm or sputum, and there can be some blood in that for some patients. Fever is common. Night sweats, so heavy sweating at night, having to change clothes or change sheets, losing weight that's unintentional without trying, so is common. Swollen lymph nodes can be a sign of tuberculosis. One of the tricks for TB too, though, most people, if they do get sick, it's in the lungs, somewhere around 2/3 to 3/4 of people who get sick from TB, the lungs is where they get sick. But the other a quarter to a third of patients, it can show up somewhere else in the body. If it is outside of the lungs, it's not contagious to other people, but it also can be harder for folks to diagnose because they may not think about tuberculosis.
Can it be fatal?
It can be. Unfortunately, there are people who die of tuberculosis every year in the U.S. Globally, it is the number one infectious disease killer of people. So about 1.3 million people die in the world from tuberculosis every year. For several years, COVID-19 surpassed tuberculosis. But with the decline in COVID, tuberculosis has now taken that unfortunate title back of being the leading killer.
And what is the treatment for someone who gets sick with TB now?
The treatment is a combination of antibiotics that are usually taken for 6 to 9 months. It's generally 4 different types of antibiotics taken for the first 2 months. And then if the tuberculosis is sensitive to all of those medications, then we can stop 2 of them and continue to for an additional 4 to 7 months. The good news is it is treatable and curable. One of the challenges is that the medications we're using are the same medications for the last 50 years. We've not had major advances in treating drug-sensitive tuberculosis in that time, and the medications are hard. They cause a lot of side effects and are difficult to take. We talk to people about, when we talk about tuberculosis treatment, we often refer to it as a form of chemotherapy because a lot of the side effects are similar, and it takes a lot to get people through a full course of treatment.
All right, what about the bird flu? How much of a risk does it pose to humans?
Right now, the risk is very low. So we've had about 70 cases in the U.S. I just recently heard that there was 68. I heard that there were two new cases diagnosed within the last week. And in all or nearly all of those cases, that people had direct contact with either birds or livestock that were sick. There's not been any human-to-human transmission. What's concerning is the high rates of bird flu circulating within the animal population and within a population that does come in contact with humans, that those are the conditions that can lead to a change where the viruses undergo mutations all the time. And if there's a mutation that allows the virus to more easily infect people and to cause more severe disease and spread from person to person, that's the tipping point where we can see bird flu becoming a real danger and potentially causing a pandemic.
Here we are. It's the middle of February. What can our listeners be doing right now, Dr. Belknap, to improve their chances of staying healthy throughout the winter?
Yeah, the things that people can do right now, one important one certainly is if anyone has not gotten the influenza vaccine, it's not too late. It is worthwhile to get the vaccine. It does not prevent people from getting the flu, unfortunately, but it makes the likelihood that you would have very severe disease and potentially need to be hospitalized from the flu much less. So it is worth getting. The other things that are always helpful is, if you're around other people in open spaces, making sure that you're washing your hands regularly or being diligent with that. We tell people if they are sick to stay home and avoid contact with others. That's how we minimize the spread of most of these viruses, as being smart. And if you're someone who has a weaker immune system, thinking carefully if you're going to be out in public places or around lots of people, that those are going to be higher risk environments for you, and you may want to consider is it worth it.
Dr. Robert Belknap with the Public Health Institute at Denver Health, leading off today's conversation here at Native America Calling. And we have the phone lines open for listeners who would like to join the conversation. If you have any concerns about some of these infectious diseases that are going around this winter, we've got answers on the show today. Just give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-996-2848. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Native radio stations and other broadcast outlets that receive federal funding are readying for serious cuts that could jeopardize their ability to operate. President Donald Trump expressed his opposition to public media during the campaign. We'll hear about concerns for the future of Native broadcast media on the next Native America Calling.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Native America Calling. We are getting information on the current spread of infectious diseases like tuberculosis, and we want to know, what are your concerns about public health risks in your community? Join this conversation. Let us know with a comment or question by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's now talk with Dean Seneca, CEO and founder of Seneca Scientific Solutions. And Dean, after listening to Dr. Belknap before the break, what else do we need to understand about these ongoing communicable diseases for Native Americans? How large of a public health threat do they represent?
Well, in the case of TB, you know, we have several of our populations that have been impacted by TB. Throughout Indian country and a lot of TB in Alaska. First off, I'd like to say the doctor did an excellent job of explaining these viruses and their transmittability, impact on public health, and things that we really need to watch out for. The only thing that I would add is that regarding TB, if you have TB and let's say HIV, for example, you know, your body's really going to be challenged to build its immunity to fight these viruses. And if one of those viruses kick off, let's say HIV, and really challenging it, it's easy, as the doctor has pointed out, for TB to activate, right? So those are major challenges if you have TB and HIV. The other thing regarding the bird flu, the flu is also in wild birds throughout the whole country, right? And, you know, I mean, it's impossible literally to survey all of these birds and wild birds throughout the whole country. And so what we're really concerned is, you know, our surveillance is not as strong among the animal population as it is the human population. And, you know, what our concern is that we don't want this virus, and when it has a lot of infectivity, it can mutate. And what we're really watching out for is that if it mutates and gets a human phenotype, that it could easily impact humans, and then, you know, in my opinion, having worked on the first H1N1 outbreak, this could easily be the next pandemic. A very, very good job, and these are things that we need to watch out for as public health professionals.
Now, these diseases, are they putting more of a strain than usual on Native healthcare systems?
Well, I think regarding tuberculosis, probably that's something that we have to watch out for. And, we have had tuberculosis outbreaks in the Midwest. Again, in Alaska and, you know, around a lot of our tribal communities. You have to remember our tribal communities are susceptible to a lot of these viruses and things. And, you know, we have at-risk populations and we have a population with a lot of pre-existing conditions, which, you know, a virus like TB could easily run rapid through.
All right. Thanks, Dean. I want to bring Shonda Hessen into the conversation now. She is in Anchorage, Alaska. And Shonda, as we noted at the top of the show, and both Dr. Belknap and Dean have reiterated, tuberculosis cases are on the rise. How is the disease affecting Alaskans, both Native and non-Native people?
Hi, and thank you again for inviting me. And Dean and Dr. Belknap did a wonderful job at providing that foundation and information for tuberculosis. In our state, Alaska has had a long history fraught with TB. I always think it's important to go back to the historical context of tuberculosis here to know where we were to where we are at the present. We have consistently been in the top one or two of incidence rates in the nation for tuberculosis over the last 10 plus years. In the 1950s, it was the leading cause of death in our Alaska population until there was medication to treat active TB. And so we've had a lot of historical trauma context of tuberculosis in our smaller communities back in the 17th and 1800s when the explorers and hunters, traders brought TB into Alaska. It was kind of the perfect storm. We have small communities that are off the road system. They didn't have access to a lot of health care, isolated a lot of people in one household. So the context, really, what we saw in the past really is continuing today. Alaska has a unique epidemiology of TB, whereas in the lower 48 and the rest of the nation, a lot of the active TB cases are some from our foreign-born population, from countries that are endemic with TB, whereas in Alaska, in our 2023 case demographics, our foreign-born population consisted of 9%, whereas our American Indian Alaska Native population was 86% of our cases. So there is a disproportionate burden on our Alaska Native population, as well as regionally, we have a disproportionate case rate of tuberculosis.
As we all know, Alaska is a huge state, Shonda, and we have many, many partnering stations throughout Alaska that listen to Native America Calling every day. Where are some of the hot spots right now for tuberculosis?
So it's consistently been our southwestern region and our northern region in the state where we have the most highest incident rates. I can say for our 2024 provisional numbers that we have, our Alaska total incidence rates is sitting around 12.8, where the nation is typically between 2 and 3 incident rate per 100,000 population. And in our southwestern, we're looking at 108.6 incident rate per 100,000, and the northern 65.2. So we definitely have spots in Alaska that are primarily where our Alaska Native population resides. We have rural communities, small villages that are disproportionately affected.
You're working with several tribal governments in Alaska. What are some strategies that you're working on to reduce the threat of these infections?
Absolutely, and I can't say enough about our partnership with our regional health corporations in Alaska. It has been an amazing partnership, and we could not do what we do without them. Some of our strategies that we use, so for us, we have our public health department, which we are centrally we're a central state public health, so we have 16 public health centers across Alaska serving 250 rural communities. We partner with our Alaska Native Health System. We do a lot of partnership with our Norton Sound Community Health Corporation, which is up in the northern area, our Yukum-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, which is down in our southwestern area, and we work very closely to partner on both outreach of active TB cases, making sure that we have good communication, good partnership, our contact investigations, screening within our high incident rate villages, and really planning our strategic planning together. And with that, I will also say one of the huge pieces of this is partnering with our local tribal health, our local tribal administration within these villages to get the community involved and get the voice of the community and make sure that they're an advisory group to our public health actions and what we're doing to help control tuberculosis, because they are the number one partner in our activities.
Now, we heard earlier that antibiotics are the way to treat tuberculosis. Do you have any challenges there in Alaska with distributing antibiotics across the state?
Absolutely. We have, as I mentioned, a lot of our areas that have a high burden of tuberculosis are off the road system. And so, as you can imagine, some of them are only accessible by plane or by boat. We don't have local public health presence within a lot of these villages. So we rely heavily on our partners at the Regional Health Corporation. Our local clinics and our community health aides are absolutely amazing. But we run into weather challenges a lot when we're trying to do our public health outreach and activities. So we are very fluid in what we plan and what we do. Another challenge is with tuberculosis, it's recommended that they get what's called DOT, which is direct observed therapy, which is where you have a person who's trained to watch the person with active TB disease take their medication, and we recommend it on a 5-day-a-week. As Dr. Belknap mentioned, it's a very long treatment. It's difficult to get through. It has side effects. And so what we want to do is really support that patient in getting through their treatment. 6 to 9 months average is a very long time to take meds, and keeping that momentum going can be difficult. So one of the challenges we do face here is finding people who can be that direct absorb therapy aid and really work with the patients to help support them and get them through treatment.
Thank you, Shonda. We've got the phone lines open. Studio in Albuquerque, New Mexico is waiting for your call, 1-800-996-2848. If you are in an Alaska Native community, you're listening to the show right now and you're thinking, geez, this tuberculosis, this sounds serious. If you got questions, we've got answers. So give us a call, 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's talk more about the bird flu now. And to do that, I want to bring another guest into the conversation. Joining us from Portland, Oregon is Catherine Minthorn. She is an owner of Res Chicks Co-op, and she is Umatilla. Catherine, good morning, and welcome back to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. I was reminded when I make my weekly trip to the grocery store on Saturday that bird flu is contributing to a national shortage of eggs. But you're a producer, and I'm curious to know from your standpoint how you describe the bird flu threat.
Well, and I'm here in Eastern Oregon in Pendleton, not Portland. We are out in the country, so we don't have a high traffic of, say, anybody that might bring bird flu in. The only problems we may encounter would be from feral birds, you know, that are flying over our coops. We haven't in the 4 years had any problems with any health other than, you know, maybe old age or dog attacks happening to our birds.
Is there ever a worry that you and some of the other people working there could be exposed to bird flu?
No, we haven't worried about it. We haven't had any detections of bird flu in the eastern side of Oregon.
Mm. President Trump is unveiling a national plan for bird flu that is steering away from culling entire flocks, and it focuses more on vaccinations and reducing exposure. Do you have a sense for how that might work?
Well, I'd say for producers who are wanting to stay natural with their production, we have historically never vaccinated any of our birds. The feed that we feed to them is all natural, produced by a local cereal grain producer that mixes wheat, barley, and peas. And on that particular operation is very limited in their chemical input into their feed. So the feed that we put into these birds is really natural. And again, saying the no vaccinations, we don't worm them. There's just no chemicals going into our birds. But I suppose if a vaccination came forward that would keep them healthy, you know, and protect them from getting the bird flu, that we would be open to that.
Mm-hmm. Catherine, how big is your flock, and what are some ways you work to prevent the spread of bird flu to all these chickens?
We have four coops within our cooperative, and each one of them is located at a separate site. So the chances of, if one coop got infected with bird flu, that it's not going to spread to the rest of the coops because none of them are in the same location. So that helps keep our business viable, you know, that we're not all going to go under at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So we meet weekly on Wednesdays. We'll meet tonight. We haven't really had concerns about it, you know, that it may hit our coops, but if it does, then that's life.
Mm. Well, let's talk more about the business side of Res Chicks. I know it was created to solve the problem of food insecurity during the COVID pandemic. How has your company evolved since then?
Well, when we started, we had two coops. We're up to four coops now. We, in 2024, with the Umatilla tribe have become a vendor producing the farm fresh eggs for the FDIPRA program. That's the commodity foods. It's the food distribution program on Indian reservations funded through USDA's Food Nutrition Service. So when we first started, that was our ultimate goal, was to raise chickens and provide a good healthy source of protein here locally on the reservation.
Mm. Now, were you always aware of bird flu and other threats from the very beginning? And if so, did you create a plan in the early days when you first started the business for how you would deal with those risks?
Bird flu came kind of came onto the radar about probably a year, 18 months after we started. Short of locking them up inside of a building to keep, you know, migratory birds from flying over, the only thing that we've done is put up, we have what's called electric poultry netting. It's electric chicken fence around our operations to keep any other predators, and it also keeps feral birds out. One of the issues that comes up is, like a lot of people will throw feed out on the grounds for their chickens to walk around, and they call it scratching, but for them to be pecking on the ground and picking their feet up. We have feeders that they're self-feeding the chickens. We have to train chickens to do this, but they step on it's on a treadle, and then the lid pops open and the chickens feed themselves. And then when they step off that treadle, the lid falls down. So it keeps rodents, feral birds, or anything. There's no excess food scattered around in their feeding area. Same thing with their water. There's a self-watering system where they touch a button and it fills up a little water cup and they water themselves. So those are two precautions that we've taken.
Well, ResChick sounds like a really fascinating business, and it sounds like you folks are doing really well. So congratulations on all your success, Catherine. And we're going to take another short break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to talk more with Dean Seneca, and we're also going to learn about public health issues in Samoa. So stay with us, and if you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-996-2848. We've got our producers standing by. We're waiting for your call. So join the conversation, 1-800-99-NATIVE.
Trickster Cultural Center, an authentic first voice of Native American veterans and cultural arts, will host the 2025 Pride Celebration honoring diversity through Native drum and dance, artistry, resource exchanges, and vendor fare. Trickster Cultural Center's Pride Celebration is open to everyone at no charge June 7th from 2 to 7 p.m. in Schaumburg, Illinois. More under events at TricksterCulturalCenter.org or at 847-301-2090. Trickster Cultural Center supports this show.
When you file online for your Permanent Fund Dividend, every Alaskan can support great causes, including Native America Calling. Just use Pick, Click, Give and select KNBA-FM, Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Through your support, you can help us make a difference in our community when you pick, click, give for causes you care about. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Program support by AmeriCorps Vista, where you can kickstart your career and help others in your community. With AmeriCorps Vista, you can serve in an office setting and address issues of poverty while gaining career experience and building your leadership skills. Learn more by visiting AmeriCorps.gov/Vista today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/Vista.
Native Forward Scholars Fund scholarships are open now. Native Forward supports Native students' higher education journeys, offering over 40 scholarship opportunities, programs, and resources designed for Native students. Info and applications at nativeforward.org, who support this show. Support for journalism that raises the awareness of child well-being to citizens and to policymakers provided by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, building a brighter future for children, families, and communities. Information at aecf.org.
You're listening to Native America Calling, and we're hearing insights into various public health threats. One of those, from a treatment standpoint, is the announcement by the Trump administration, later rescinded, that almost 1,000 IHS staff would be losing their jobs. You can join us by calling 1-800-996-2848. Let's hear a concern about public health from Samoa. The South Pacific Islands have a total population of 250,000 people, nearly all of whom are indigenous Samoan. The leaders of the Commonwealth have been among those speaking out against the selection of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as U.S. Health Secretary. That's because of his long record of supporting unfounded claims about vaccines, including during a 2019 trip to Samoa at a time when vaccination rates there were about 30%. The Director General of Samoa's Health Ministry is Aino Dr. Alec Ikaroma. He spoke earlier via Zoom with NEC producer Sol Traverso. Ikaroma claims Kennedy's leadership could be devastating for the health of indigenous people around the world.
For someone who has been to Samoa, have seen and talked to anti-vaxxers in Samoa, sown misinformation across Samoa, and emboldened the anti-vaxxers, will have repercussions here. So that's the reason why I'm against the appointment of Robert Kennedy. His presence and his dialogue with the anti-vaxxers here emboldened them to speak out against our vaccination efforts. So that's what we're afraid of, really, is that the disinformation and misinformation has continued right up to this day, against all evidence that there is, there was measles that caused the deaths here in Samoa. We will have to make sure that any anti-vaccination activity that occurs in Samoa and across our region is closely monitored, and to make sure that we put in place steps, strategies to make sure that they are neutralized. The most recent one is COVID. The anti-vaxxers put up billboards on government land saying that the COVID vaccine caused heart disease and caused death. Well, that's the kind of misinformation, really, that's also been espoused by Kennedy. So that's ongoing with the anti-vaxxers. They're holding on to their own views. It's very hard to shake the anti-vaxxers. So we don't want to debate with them, because we stick to evidence, medical evidence, research evidence that comes from randomized controlled trials, and we are convinced. And so are the 17,000 doctors in the United States who signed a petition for Kennedy not to be appointed. So that sends a strong message that the medical community is against the appointment of Kennedy because of the disinformation that he sows across not only the United States now, but across the globe. And it will affect us.
That was a taped interview with Aino Dr. Alec Ikaroma, Samoa's top public health official. Dean Seneca is on the line in New York. He's the CEO and founder of Seneca Scientific Solutions. And Dean, let's talk a little bit about President Trump having eliminated nearly 1,000 Indian health employees. Newly appointed Health Secretary Robert Kennedy rescinded that order. Does that indicate Kennedy has a grasp of health challenges facing Indian country?
Well, let's hope so. You know, I guess when he did that, he made a comment that his father was always complaining that Indian Health Service was under-resourced and really didn't have everything it needed to really address good health and wellness in Indian country. So let's hope he has a little bit of understanding toward indigenous health issues. But, you know, there's major concerns with his appointment.
Well, let's talk about that, and specifically these issues with regard to vaccine misinformation. What's your thought?
You know, we have a secretary now who does not endorse nor promote evidence-based science. And this is huge for the health scientific community. I mean, this impacts everything from health promotion, disease prevention, health research, messaging. You know, he has said that the MMR vaccine does cause autism because of the famous Wakefield study. And we know that, well, first, that study has been debunked. It was a kind of an invalid study, really didn't have enough participants. And there was a big underlying agenda with that study that all has come out. There's been other studies, though, with, you know, 135,000 children involved in that study. And overwhelmingly, the evidence shows that, you know, the vaccine does not cause autism. And then the other, you know, which really was concerning to me, and, you know, during his Senate confirmation, he said that black people should have a different schedule of COVID-19 vaccinations because of their immunity is different. And, you know, he was quoting a Mayo Clinic study in which he was making this conclusion. Now, you know, my first thought was, you know, well, how does this address mixed races, right? I mean, where do they fall into this schedule? And then the other is that, you know, any, you know, good health researcher or health scientist knows that we all have different immune systems, right? And race and sex can, you know, as well as many other factors can influence that immune system, right? But, you know, even Richard Kennedy, the guy that was overseeing, the guy that was overseeing the Mayo Clinic study, he said, you know, but suggesting African Americans should have a different schedule would be really twisting the data far beyond what the study actually demonstrated. So, you know, these things, first off, even making this kind of suggestion is very, very concerning because, you know, I mean, how far is he going to go in making these radical suggestions and actually try to implement them in the health community? So, you know, we all, like what was previously discussed in Samoa, we're all on guard now, right? Because we really want to know if he is going to endorse, you know, health scientific validity, right? And this puts us all, folks in health research and folks in the epidemiology world, this puts us all on edge.
Dean, you joined us many times as a guest during the COVID pandemic. What would you like to see this administration change when it comes to preparing for a public health emergency, especially in response to the health of Native people?
Well, it would really be great if this administration would really fully fund the Indian Health Service. You know, we see all this money being spent on wars and things which are costing millions and millions of dollars, billions of dollars. You know, fully funding Indian Health Service, I think the National Indian Health Board would say $40 billion. I think right now it's probably $4 to $6 billion Indian Health Service is at. That would be great if the administration would do something like that. I really do think that we need to support our tribal epicenters, really to be able to do surveillance and really partner with our tribal nations and our state health departments to really have effective on-the-spot, very active, proactive dashboards when it comes to disease surveillance. Some states do that very well, like Minnesota. Other states don't do that well at all. I hate to say that, but like the state I'm in, New York, you know, there's a lot that can be done. I really would like to see, actually, this administration invest in our health workforce. You know, we need more indigenous doctors, more indigenous health scientists, more indigenous researchers, more indigenous epidemiologists. And I think that that would actually be one of the biggest impacts to really get us on the right road to really improving the health and wellness of our tribal communities. Also, we have to invest in our traditional methods of healing, and we haven't done that really well. And that is actually paying our traditional healers to be part of the health clinic, to go and work side by side with Western practitioners. Our Western practitioners might not like that, but hey, you know, if you ask the average indigenous patient what form of healing that they would like to embrace first, I'm sure they're going to always go to our traditional medicine folks, practitioners before Western medicine. And that's something that we have to really start to embrace. And we have to really bridge that link between traditional knowledge and Western knowledge.
Okay. That's an interesting point, Dean. And I might add, though, it creates challenges because I know, like in some of the Pueblo communities where I'm from, it's not proper to compensate, to pay traditional healers. That's not the way it works in some of our communities. But let's go to the phones. We've got a couple of callers lined up. First up is Theodora, who is listening on station KMHA in North Dakota. Hello, Theodora. You're back on the air. It's good to have you calling in again.
Thank you. It's a very good topic. I had read about that there's a latent form of tuberculosis. I was wondering what the general advice is for people with the latent form of tuberculosis due to this outbreak. And I'm glad that you're including information about RFK's intentional misinformation on vaccines. I still do rely on the COVID vaccine to protect my health. Thank you.
Thank you, Theodora. Let's bring Shonda Hessen back into the conversation. Shonda, could you respond to Theodore's questions regarding tuberculosis?
Yes, hello. Thank you. And that is a great question. When we talk about the priorities for TB, one of our top priorities are to find and treat TB infection, which is LTBI, latent TB infection, so that we prevent it from becoming active TB sometime during the future. So recommendations, if you have a positive TB skin test or a positive blood test, and everything else looks negative for active TB and you're diagnosed with latent TB, there are medications that you can take to help your body get rid of that tuberculosis so you do not become active in the future. They're a much shorter course of treatment than active TB, and we would recommend following up with your healthcare provider.
All right, thank you, Shonda. Next up is Chanupa, listening on Keeley Radio in Pine Ridge, South Dakota. Big brother, you're on the air.
Hey, whoopie la tonka for all the elders that I've been looking for here on Pine Ridge because of understanding, because of what's going on. Now, hey, honey, our ancestors told us long ago, compared to your understanding or happening to this day, we need to go back hobo traditional. And I want to tell you, Sean, there's a group called Raw Omega, okay? Raw Omega. It's a meal, okay? And our people need to go back long ago to our way because they're like they say, Taku Tokta Ampeto Onzi Ukte Ash Skawi Chasha Tony Wokikile Onkupsni. See? So our ancestors need to go back to a raw meal. It's Oregon. And so call me back after the show, Sean, and we're going to talk about that. And then maybe we can help people, some of the other elders, to get that. So whoop it up, hunk up from everybody. And even the lady that's talking on the show, thank her for doing her part in helping our elders. Whoop it up, ha-ho.
Wopalatunka, big brother, and I'll give you a call back after the show and we'll talk more. And Dean, Chanupa reiterates what you were talking about, the importance of our traditional ways, diets and such for healing. And I want to also ask you, because you talked about the importance of having more Native American healthcare providers and these concerns now, this rhetoric from the Trump administration about rolling back DEI initiatives, what could the effect be there with regard to Native people who are interested in careers in healthcare?
Well, first off, I really, you know, to your point, we really need to endorse traditional medicine, and we need to kind of figure out how we bring that back in our communities. I did want to say, though, that the new secretary, Kennedy, did say that he, in his confirmation, that he would bring someone senior in his inner circle in the secretary's office who was indigenous and an advocate for Indian health. And our tribal nations need to hold them accountable to that. DEI is huge. You know, I wish people would hire the most qualified person, because I've always been the most qualified person for many jobs that I've applied for. I wasn't hired. And I'd give you a small good example. When I finished undergraduate work, you know, I'm from the urban Indian area, South Buffalo, urban Indian area. I grew up among the Irish. I love my community. I love my Irish people. I love the whole city. I would always go. There was a mayor who was Irish at the time, and I would always go to all these campaign parties. When it was time for jobs, I was by far the most qualified among my friends and colleagues. I never got a job. And it's because of DEI that I was able to actually get my first job, because DEI actually was able to get me noticed, right? And my first assignment at CDC was, you know, a DEI position, but it wasn't classified as DEI. But if it wasn't for DEI at the time, I would never have started out my career as an Indigenous health professional at one of the major health prevention organizations in the world.
All right. Dean, I'm sorry we're out of time. We're going to have to wrap up the conversation. But I hear other people say similar things, that the DEI, it can get your foot in the door, but once you're there, you've got to earn your keep. So thank you for joining the show. All of our guests, Dean Seneca, Catherine Minthorn, Shonda Henson, Dr. Robert Belknap, and Samoan Health Ministry Director, Dr. Alec Ikaruma. Join us again tomorrow as we look at rising concerns regarding the future of Native public radio and TV stations. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day. I'm Sean Spruce.
See Renewal's expertise in energy, housing, land use, fire protection, and more in multi-jurisdictional environments helps tribes leverage existing assets, grow capacity, and gain competitive advantage. See Renewal supports this show. SEERenewal.com. DT Track, your healthcare partner, provides access to a nationwide network of qualified healthcare temporary staff, including medical billing professionals that optimize your revenue cycles. More at dt-track.com who support this show. Repatriation is the return of ancestors and stolen culture. The Association on American Indian Affairs and the Tunica Biloxi Tribe will host the 10th Annual Repatriation Conference, February 25th, 26th, and 27th, 2025 in Marksville, Louisiana. The conference will provide expert hands-on training about domestic and international repatriation. Registration and more information available at Indian-Affairs.org. The Association on American Indian Affairs supports this show.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.